Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are breaking down the rhetoric out there in the world, cleaning it up, making it pure and good and all things wholesome. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So I'm trying to get people up on their game and rhetoric a little bit more. I am Dr. Dan, American rhetorician. That's me, escaped professor, jumped right out of the ivory tower. Also late night comedy writer from Hollywood, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I have this podcast that I bring my friends on. And right now, like I've done, I think you're number 33, Paul.
No.
And 29 of them have been basically middle-aged white guys.
No, what's up with that?
Apparently that's the only people I know. I've got others, but
you don't have a token black friend somewhere.
You know, at this point, whoever I bring on that's not a middle-aged white guy is going to feel like a token. So I'm caught.
Oh, you mean like Biden's cabinet right now?
I'm in the vice. So we'll come back to it. So the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics, and my guest today does comedy, so that's cool. I have conservatives on because I'm fascinated by it, and I often try to convert conservatives, but I'll also convert liberals. My daughter's a super liberal, way, way lefty liberal, and I'm always pulling her back because millennial liberalism drives me nuts like it does for a lot of people. So, and I also bring on people who have persuasion experience out in the world and a certain expertise, and my guest does that today as well. So, and my big claim to fame for the podcast is I have more rhetoricians on my podcast than any other podcast in the world. I think we're up to 11 rhetoricians. So, my guest this week, I've known this guy for a long time. I met him through comedy, through stand-up. He's a sales guy, as I know him, like sells tech, semiconductors, oil field stuff. And again, my vague knowledge of Paul is that he's Texan. He's a dude. He drives a truck. I know that because he helped me move. And he has some conservative posts. Other than that, I don't know a darn thing about his politics, but I thought it'd be fun to talk to him. So everybody welcome Paul Sontag. Paul.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, you know, I'd probably classify myself as a libertarian, although I've never registered for that. So it may surprise you to know that I voted libertarian almost every presidential election. Almost every, starting with Ross Perot, you know, the guy that stole the election from George H.W. Bush and gave it to Clinton. If it wasn't for Ross Perot stealing 19% of the popular vote, Clinton would have never been president. And that's
Perot, man,
fact.
That guy was an interesting dude. Like, they've been trying to get business people into politics through some side door for a long time. They had Steve Forbes, you know, they had Ross Perot. Mm-hmm. And these guys, and you know, Perot, he made a splash. He was quite a character.
Well, you know, the reason I went for it was, hey, what do lawyers know about running a country? And running a country is like running a business. And I've been in project management and been, saddled with budgets. And his platform was then at the time, 1992, I have a plan to pay off the then $3 trillion deficit in 3 years. And Saturday Night Live made fun of him. Everybody poo-pooed on him because he was an outsider. And so
it wasn't just that. He was also a little, he has a comic. There was a comic element to that guy.
Oh, yeah.
He was about definitely tall and he talked like, you know, a Texan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then so, you know, Trump is basically the second coming of him. Here's another guy that says, hey, why don't we run the country like a business? And so, you know, I think that's why Trump got in.
You think the business aspect of that was the rhetorical thing that everybody held on to is like, I want a business guy in the presidency.
Well, I think what people connected with Trump was he wasn't a politician. You know, his whole thing about draining the swamp and all that. He was saying, okay, I mean, he was a very brash guy and, you know, you cannot apologize for his personality at all. But, you know, why did making America great again ever become such a horrible thing in the liberal democratic society? You can tell me that. I have no idea.
Well, I think it's a good question. Like, what? But so in rhetoric, you always go back to a couple of, there are tools that you use over and over again. And one is word choice and word definition. So what does it mean, great? That's the operative term and all that. So what does a great America look like? Like to me, you know, like people will say, oh, Dan, you're liberal. I'm like, no, you know what I am? I'm a comedian. I want a comedian friendly country. That's my first and primary thing. So like to me, a great America is, you know, comedians get paid for jokes.
Like we don't have that right now, do we?
What, a funny country?
A comedian friendly country.
No, not at all. It's
you can't tell jokes anymore, right? You're going to offend someone.
You can tell jokes, but there's going to be bad reaction to those jokes and it's going to have horrible effects on your life.
Well, if you're Dave Chappelle, you can get away with it.
Well, the thing about politics, I wrote for Dennis Miller, uber conservative, you know, guy. And his entire staff was all lefty, you know, liberal, you know, writers, because almost all writers are liberals because they want basically just a wide open creative environment. They don't want to be called out on anything. So I've been around that world and it's really hard to do comedy down. Like Dennis Miller ran into this all the time. He was punching downward at people as opposed to punching upwards. And Chappelle's always punching up because he's always punching, you know, at white culture, the majority culture. So he can say whatever he wants. But you can't go downward.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that thread, you know, if comedic writers are liberal and they want to keep it wide open so you can talk about anything, how do you explain how polarized a Saturday Night Live has become over the last, I don't know, 5-6 years.
It's always been a lefty show. I mean, very first season, like they were right after, you know, they'll go after any politician, but they go after right-wing politicians hard.
Well, I watched Norm MacDonald doing a, you know, Weekend Update, like all his jokes about the Clintons and OJ. And I mean, his stuff was definitely not lefty and he got away with it for a long time until, you know, they said, hey, that's too right. And then they got rid of him. But he got away with it for a long time.
He's super acerbic. Like, he takes shots at anybody. Like, I don't know what Norm's politics are. I know him a little bit, and I really admire him as a comic. And he's just brilliant and acerbic. Like, anybody steps in his path, they're going to get it.
He was the first comedian that inspired me to even want to even look into pursuing comedy. And I saw him, I think I was watching him Comedy Central back when they used to have stand up on Comedy Central, you know, when I was 19 years old. Yeah. Now I'm 50. Yeah. Back when MTV played videos.
Those days. Back when America was great.
Well, there you go. So first of all, let's stay on that thread. He stole that from Ronald Reagan. That was his thing. Make America great again. But somehow the media got a hold of it and made that racist. You know, the way I interpret him saying make America great again is through some of his actions, like canceling the NAFTA deal and replacing it with a better trade deal for Mexico and Canada, going hard against China, where we've had a lopsided import-export fees for 20, 30 years. And of course, China hates him and they love Biden. And you got to ask yourself why. You know, Trump's out, Biden's in, things are going to go back the way they were. He was helping to bring jobs in, at least that was his goal. NAFTA sent jobs out. I remember seeing train car after train car come up from Mexico with Ford frames on it, go into factories in Detroit because they're building or subcontracting in Mexico. And so, that's how I interpreted make America great again. I never interpreted it as, hey, let's make it white again. But somehow that was the underlying, seems to be what was attached to that meaning.
Well,
I don't
think that's absolutely true. So let's take a look at it. So one of the things, too, in rhetoric is you make claims, right? So everybody makes a claim. And then you've got to take some time to actually look at the evidence to see whether you can support that claim or not. So that idea that, you know, like you compared Reagan's Make America Great and Trump's Make America Great. Were they the same? Like you implied that the media somehow morphed it into racism. But Reagan never said build a wall and keep out illegal immigrants. Like, he was not anti-immigrant. That was not part of his policy.
You're absolutely right. And I don't think Trump is anti-immigrant. He's anti-illegal immigrant. And, you know, as we're talking about the wall, Obama built plenty of wall. These child detention.
So I'm going to play a game with you if it's okay. So I'm going to hold you, like, I don't, like, let, especially logic discussions drift horribly. Yeah. You can never get anything done.
I'm with you.
So let's stay with, he did want, like, it was a clear pillar of Trump that he wanted to build a wall and slow and change immigration. Partly that was to stop illegal immigration, but he also slowed down legal immigration. Like, he had a problem with the way America does immigration.
I'll agree with you on that. Because he was talking about allowing immigrants to come in based on merit. Like, what can they bring to the country? And that is very un-American. Okay.
Yeah, we've never had a meritocracy to let people in this country. There's a lot of people who wouldn't be here right now.
You're right, including my great-grandfather, who was a legal immigrant through the Port of Galveston and never told anybody where he's from. So I'm a fourth generation.
So should they? Yeah. So within that theory of illegal immigrants are bad, should we go and just drag you guys back out? And where would you go? Where would they throw you? Clearly some white Nordic country.
I would hope Bermuda. But I mean, okay, so I think the last number I heard, and this was, you know, within the last 12 to 18 months, you know, while Trump was still president, legal immigrants were 150,000 a month, but illegal immigrants had matched that at 150,000 a month. So the point is, if you have just, you know, right now we've got a bunch of Hondurans marching towards the border, all right?
Like, you know, marching Hondurans? We have marching Hondurans.
Hondurans are marching towards the border through Mexico.
I get the image of like 10 soldiers all, like, you know, with the hats and everything. But
well, they're not strolling. Hondurans. They're making a mad dash because Biden's president now. I mean, look, there's a definite cost related upon that. You know, Biden's talking about giving them all the types of benefits. And of course, Americans go, well, what about the benefits for Americans first? Before we try to take care of, and so if you just open up the floodgates and let everybody in, and you don't have any border, you don't have a country, and then everyone's going to be poor eventually.
All right, so you took me down a nice slippery slope there, at you know, high speed. Let everybody in, we're all poor, and we have no country. Three massive claims. Nobody would want that. Nobody would want just completely open borders in America because you can't run a country like that.
Okay. Kind of what's going on right now.
Well, let's stay off Biden. Let's stay on Trump because I love the Trump-Reagan comparison.
Okay.
Because Reagan is a guy who won the conservative game. Like, I was in college when Reagan came in 1981. And I went to college from 81 to 85. And when Reagan started, I was going to college for free. I had, you know, grants. And, you know, college was free and had some extra money to live on. And it was great. By the time he was done 2 years later, I was paying like $7,000-$8,000 a year to go to college. So that's one of my direct experiences of Reagan. He came in and basically defunded education.
He defunded education. Well, you've got me there. I definitely wasn't in 81. I was 11 learning how to drive. So I just didn't experience that myself, but I do remember working my ass out off in the service industry to pay my way through college. And it was about like what you said.
Yeah. It's hard. Like, I think I'm an intellectual, I'm an academic. So one of the things I would vote for is, you know, funded education. Like, I don't think people should have to go into massive debt to get a good education in this country. But again, the right wing and the conservatives have a different approach to it. It's like, you should pay for everything you get in this country. That's one of the conservative principles.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
It definitely is. It is. I'll explain it to you. Conservatives don't want the government to provide for them. and they don't want to pay taxes for their off their hard work and earnings for people who don't want to do the same thing. You know, so I mean, the problem with socialism, and that's kind of what you're talking about, free stuff.
I don't use that word. That's not my word. Okay. Don't throw that word on me.
Okay. All right. Well, free education, someone's got to pay for it. All right. And again, I think it was Margaret Thatcher who quoted, who said, the problem with socialism is sometimes eventually you're going to run out of other people's money.
Maybe. I mean, it depends on what, you know,
how you tax them.
It's boiled down. Like, I think one of the interesting things about conservatism is that it's a really good, straightforward rhetoric. Like, it sometimes makes comparisons like that that are hard to argue against. Yes, mm-hmm. If you're giving away money, sooner or later, you're going to run out of money.
Right.
And then everybody's like, oh, yeah, that's logical. But that's not really the way a society works. Like, if you pay for everybody's education and then they go out and get better jobs and pay more taxes, then you are actually increasing your funds instead of decreasing your funds. At least that's the argument on the other side. Now, I don't know which one's true.
Well, you know, there's a cheap joke, which is counter to that. It says, well, what'd you do with your free high school education? So, you know, I worked for it. You obviously worked for it. I mean, it took me 6.5 years to get through a 4.5 year degree. I took a year off from school to work full time to save up money to return to college. So when I did that, I started making straight A's. But if you give it for free, someone still has to pay for it. That's the point. So, you know, why?
Well, is that something that if like you personally say, this one thing has always bothered me about taxes is that you don't get to say what they do with your taxes.
Right.
Like I would say, hey, okay, let's say I pay $15,000 in tax every year. I want $5,000 of that to be put towards comedy clubs. Like I want really three really good comedy clubs in every city in the country. And I want that $5,000 to go towards that. And then I'd be much happier about my taxes.
You're going to need some good lobbyists to pull that off.
That's fine. I bet you I could sell that. I could sell that to the country.
Yeah. Well, you could sell it to every professional comedian who hasn't been able to go perform for the last year.
Exactly. Look what the resource we're wasting because we waste our comedians. You know. But well, the other 5,000, I'd be like perfectly fine for them to dump that, or the 10,000 to dump that into education. Because my father was born on a tobacco farm in Kentucky. You know, I was the first generation going to college, and it completely transformed my family.
How did it transform your family? Are you talking about your children or your people before you?
Well, in some ways, both. Like both my children are now, you know, in professional jobs. They've never had to live in Kentucky. I got them out of Kentucky because of education. But I also was able to go back and like...
You're really on a flyover state now.
Yeah, for sure. But like I was, you know, I went back and taught and would teach my mom things. I got her to go to college later in life and she loved it. And that kind of education and information changes everything around you, you know? So I would value that. I would say, yes, I'll pay extra money so people can have a really good education and not have to do what you did, which is... you know, go and work instead of getting your education.
Yeah. Well, I did that because I didn't never want to take out a loan. And that was the culture I was taught from my family. And so when I did graduate, I was debt free and I started making money immediately. And in 4 years, I was making six figures. So that's a good thing instead of having to pay off, you know, a student loan for 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. But so is that your background? Is your family conservative?
Oh yeah. Oh, they certainly are. I think I'm much more open-minded than they are. That happens. I mean, you know, they're born in the late 30s, you know? Yeah. And you know how society was back then. You're older than I am. So, you know,
yeah. So I remember my grandparents driving around the city and the things that they would say.
Oh, I remember my grandfather saying horrible things. Now, interesting enough, we had for a few years while my mom was still working before she quit her job to be a stay-at-home mom, we had a African-American nanny named May, and she worked the night shift as a nurse, and she'd get off and come in the morning, look after me and my sister for, you know, 3 or 4 hours until my mom got off work. And she was the nicest woman in the world, and she loved us. So, I mean, you know, I don't think I think it's just the way society was back then. You know, they were raised in a different environment, and, you know, what was okay then is not okay now. They loved her. They trusted her to be in their house with us. So, you know, are they racist? Nah, I think they had some racial overtones, definitely, you know.
They were backwoods Indiana racists.
I want to make something clear about what we're talking about earlier with the border situation. You know, in junior high, I had more Hispanic or Latino friends than any other friends I'd stay with overnight, hang out with all the time. I worked in a restaurant with hardworking Mexicans, most of them illegals. I know they're great people. They believe in family. They're religious. No problem with them. It's just the idea of skipping the naturalization process. Think about all the people who came here legally, how pissed off they are. Go speak to a Venezuelan who went through the naturalization process and came through legally. Does it really help them? Does it help illegal aliens to come through illegally, hide in a safe house, stay with a cousin, not have insurance? I mean, all these things, it doesn't really make it easy for them. So let as many people in as possible, but, you know, not an overflow is, that's my point. I mean, it will take a dent in the economy. There are numbers. I watched a lot of documentaries. I'm not going to quote anything specifically, but there are a number of kids who were born in the U.S. whose parents still live in Mexico. And every day they take them across the border, put them on a bus so they can go to school in the U.S. And then at night they go home back to Mexico and live with their parents. Now, are those people paying taxes in the U.S. to pay for these children in school? No. What does it cost to put a child through K through 12? It's about $10,000 a year. So if you're not paying into the system, someone else is paying for it. Okay. So, you know, that's, you know, and that goes back to my conservative values of pay for play. So, and of course, your opinion is give everybody free education.
Did I say that? Did I say everybody?
You said you'd be willing to pay more so everyone could get free education.
Yeah, we'll go back to, you know, word choice and definitions, like these are rhetoric games. Like everybody, that doesn't mean I'm like paying for, you know, Honduras, the entire, you know, country of Honduras to be educated.
Okay. Everyone inside the U.S. borders.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good thing. Like you typically find that when people get educated, they become, I think, better people, typically.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, well, okay, so you already have free education, K through 12, but it's paid, it's taxed by the homeowners. You know, your homeowner tax is paying for the school system. So, I mean, it's being paid for already. The question is higher education, will that be paid free?
Yeah.
And I can't say I really disagree with you. You know, I mean, I have friends that live in other countries. I traveled to other countries on business and learned about their cultures. And then, you know, they go, yeah, we pay like 40% income tax. And but everything's taken care of. But, you know, they're rarely going to, you know, there's always going to be the top percent. They're going to really get ahead and everybody else has a harder time at it. And also the other responses are, you know, I got to make an appointment with a doctor 3 months ahead of time because it's paid for by the government.
You know, like our understanding of socialist cultures is so limited. Like we really don't know much about them. Like that one, that's a holdover. I remember that from the 80s where like people would go after the Canadian healthcare system by saying, well, you've got to have an appointment, you know, you have cancer for 3 months before they'll even see you. Like in rhetoric, that's what I would call a stain element. And these are super powerful in rhetoric and they're all over the place on both sides. But that staining socialism with that particular little story has hooked people for decades. And is it true? I have no idea.
Well, the example I just gave you is firsthand information from my friend William Bonner, who lives in Edinburgh, Scotland. I went over there in 2008 to run the Loch Ness Marathon with him. And 2 days later, he said, Paul, I can't hang out with you today. I got to go to this doctor's appointment. I made it 3 months ago. If I cancel it, I won't have one until 3 months later. So, I mean, that's a firsthand story, and I didn't make it up.
No, so I don't believe that, you made it up. It's one story, right? In one country.
Yeah, okay. I mean, he said that's the way it is in Scotland or the UK. I mean, so, you know, I'm sure they didn't single him out because his name is William Bonner.
No, but so the other game we play here is we look at the quality of your evidence. And it's not trying to disprove your evidence, because I think that's bad rhetoric. I think going around just trying to slap everybody down and prove them wrong is a bad way of doing, you know, persuasion. It's a bad way of doing communication in general. So I'm not saying that's untrue or that's not a valuable piece of information. It's just a tiny, tiny piece of information.
Sure.
There's so many socialist countries and there's so many different ways of doing that stuff that we can't really draw much of a conclusion from that story.
No.
But it's still valuable. I mean, I'd love to hear more, you know, from people that are actually in the socialist systems about whether they like it or not, because then I can make an informed decision. Right now, I know nothing about it.
My impression is they just didn't know anything different. They just, from, you know, their visits to the U.S., to Austin, you know, people I dealt with in business and in Houston, they would point out the differences, you know, as well, you know, what they thought was weird about America. And sure. You know, I'd travel over there and I go, wow, French do really eat bread and cheese with every meal. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what my daughter is saying. Yeah.
And no one's fat. No one's fat because they use like 4 ingredients to make their bread. You know, it's not GMO bread. It's not, wheat isn't supplied by Monsanto. You know, I mean, it's crazy. They're all skinny. They all walk a lot. They all use mass transit. I mean, everybody, there's lots of cars. But, when I was in Paris, I'd walk on average 6 to 10 miles a day.
Well, see, that sounds like a better way to live. Why don't we do that here?
Because it's scorching hot and it's too far. You want to walk to Round Rock from San Marcos? Good luck.
Yeah, I know. But so why don't we redo our cities? Like they're talking about going back into New York now. You know, Robert Moses, the architect in New York in the 70s, you know, basically destroyed neighborhoods and destroyed the walking nature of a lot of that parts of that city by putting in highways. And, you know, and they're talking about going in and tearing down those highways, sort of connecting the communities and figuring out better ways to do the road system.
Right. You know, something very unique about the architecture in Paris, you know, I noticed it really well when I went up into the Eiffel Tower and looked down. Everything is like a wheel.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Okay, I got to put my hands up here so you can see it. I mean, it's a radial wheel, and there's all these 4 and 5 story, you know, all the apartment complexes kind of look the same, very structured, but they're all in like circles, and in the traffic circle around it, you on the first floor, you walk around, there's a butcher shop, there's a cheese shop, there's a vegetable shop, you know, whatever, and you get home from work and you walk around and buy exactly what you need for dinner. You go upstairs and you cook it because you only have a tiny apartment and your refrigerator is this big.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I think that's a better way to live. And when I lived in downtown Austin, I lived like 500 feet from Whole Foods, and I would go there and get lunch almost every day.
Yeah.
And just buy what I need for the, you know, instead of letting produce go to waste. But now I'm living in San Marcos in the outskirts, and you go to HEB and you load up, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's the thing too. And I think when I look at stuff like Trump talking about immigration and what it does to sort of reorient the way we think about other people, non-Americans, you know, in general, like to label them illegal and illegal is a very, you know, definitive distinction. And to create enough of like fear of people coming here illegally, like you talked about caravans and people marching and, you know, scrambling over the border and all that kind of stuff. It makes us afraid of other cultures versus making us look at like innovations and things we can learn from other cultures to make things here better. And that's one of the things I always loved about New York. Is New York has been just wave after wave after wave of immigration, and they take the best stuff and they just hold on to it. You know, all the food there is amazing. And like, you know, not that New York is perfect, but it's infused by culture. And I think that's part of the American story that like a president should really focus on as a positive, as opposed to a negative. And I think Trump negativized it much more so even, like I said, Reagan didn't do that. And George Bush first didn't do that.
No, he didn't. But, you know, cartels are real. Coyotes are real. You know, it's documented fact that, you know, they figured out our system of coming over the border, and an adult comes with a child. It doesn't even have to be their child. They know they'll have a better chance of getting in.
Yeah, there's some of that. They're going to game. Everybody's going to game everything. Right. But again, they've been doing that forever. Like the Italians and the Irish didn't come over here, you know, with who they were. They changed their names. They gamed the system. That's what they do.
That's something to think about. So what future would you like to see for this country?
Comedian president.
Are you nominating yourself or you're running?
No, I don't want the job. I want
Reagan was pretty funny.
Reagan was an actor. You know, Reagan was a really interesting guy for the history of politics. Like, he was the first guy that, you know, was just really good with script. And he was a dramatic actor. Man, that guy could deliver a dramatic speech. Trump came along, and Trump was a reality show star, and he knows how to blow it up all the time.
Yeah.
And that kind of entertainment stuff just overwhelmed politics. Like, he took over the country. You know, you couldn't, like yesterday with Tiger Woods, you know, has a fender bender and, you know, goes into surgery, and it's 9,000 hours of coverage because he's an entertainment figure. And Trump had the same power.
Yeah. Well, he, I always said his handlers could have handled him better, but I guess he just didn't listen to him.
Dude, I don't think there was any handling him.
Like, yeah. It's like, you know, you could have said that so many ways, you know, but, definitely for effect, they call it Trump speech. You know, everything's going to be great. It's going to be better. It's going to be wonderful.
Well, he's a promoter. I mean, he has a huge history as a promoter, and that's how promoters talk.
You know,
everything is overblown, overclaimed. It's P.T. Barnum, you know, and the guy had learned that for 30, 40 years in New York. So he knew it. And then he knew how to do TV. He knew, you know, he learned how to blow up social media. Like, he was too strong for me. He was too strong for politics. Like, you don't want your politicians to be that entertaining. You know, it's just too much. It took, it took over.
Right.
I like boring Biden. I want a boring president.
Well, how long do you think he'll be before Kamala takes over?
I don't particularly find her to be interesting either. I mean, she's like, she's a pretty bland character. Like, the one I like, you know, as far as somebody that I think is an interesting character is Stacey Abrams from Georgia. You know, she's got some pop to her. I'd be interested to hear what, you know, she has to say about, you know, some of this stuff. But she's much more vibrant than Kamala Harris. She needs to fix.
Don't mispronounce it. They'll come after you.
They can come at. It's a hard name to figure out how to pronounce. Both of those are good pronunciations, and my brain won't hold on to it.
I think it was funny. They were ragging on some conservative for mispronouncing her name. It's supposed to be Kamala, I believe it. But like 2 days later, Biden's.
I think it's Kamala.
And 2 days later, Biden called her Kamala after he nominated her vice president. And like, well, how are you gonna be mad at somebody when the president who nominated you vice president can't say your name?
Yeah, except for the conservative guy was doing it, you know, on purpose for effect. It was a rhetorical move, you know.
I don't know. I think calling her Kalamata Olive Harris is, you know, for effect.
If you can make it funny, I mean, mispronouncing names is a comedy technique. It's been used a billion times. If you can make it funny, great. But if you're doing it to deride somebody, then you've got to hold, you got to take responsibility for that. You say, yes, that's why I'm doing it. Don't try to dodge me when I know that's exactly what you just did.
Yeah.
And that's kind of part of my thing here with the Rhetoric Warriors thing is I push ethical persuasion. I don't care if you're conservative. I don't care if you're liberal. I don't care what you are, as long as you're doing ethical persuasion techniques. So if you say something that's derisive towards somebody else, then own it.
Yeah.
I have no problem with derision. I do it all the time. So you came from, you're from Texas, right?
Correct. Born and raised, been here. Well, lived in Texas in my entire life.
And now you're going to move to Colorado. That's a liberal state, man.
Well, I mean, and everybody else asked me, you're going to get some good weed? I mean, there's got to be something more to Colorado than weed. And trust me, there is. Now, the deal is, my brother-in-law is basically a billy goat. He was raised in the woods. He's an avid backpacker. And so after my sister married him, I started going on these backpacking trips, like several days carrying a 50-pound pack up and over the Continental Divide numbers of times.
Oh, that's awesome.
And you don't see another human for days. And that's what I like. I like trail running and hiking. I love Colorado. Durango's beautiful. Colorado Springs would work. That's close enough. I just love it. I love the scenery. I love the mountains. I love the twisty roads. I love the pine trees. And I don't like August in Texas.
What? Come on. Aren't you a lizard? Even lizards.
Hey, you can't put enough slip and slides in the front yard to get through August in Texas. It's bad.
Yeah, well, as long as it's not Siberia in February, I'm fine. I can deal with the melt.
I can. Well, we just went through some cold. You know, we had 4 degrees here. I was feeding the fireplace for 4 days straight, shoveling soot. I mean, you know, I don't really mind the cold. I like that. And also, I'm a pretty good snowboarder. So, yeah.
Well, that's cool. And I think places like Colorado and stuff like that, for people that, yeah, I get a sense, like we've talked about this, you know, you've been in sales for a long time and, you know, anybody that's in those worlds for a certain amount of time, I just watched Death of a Salesman the other night. You know, anybody's in that world for a while, you absorb it to the point where it seems to be kind of hard to take, you know, as just a life orientation, you know, just constant sales. And then people give Hollywood this rap too. And I understand why. But like you can stand in the Hollywood Improv having a conversation with somebody and everybody just looking over everybody's shoulder to see who else is more important that might do something for them. So the social connectivity is very different. The social, you know, interaction is very different. And it's different in sales too, right? I mean, you have a different orientation to people when you're going out doing sales.
Well, say more about that.
So
different orientation.
The idea that you have to make a living, you know, get this person, help this person to a position where they'll buy from you.
Right.
You know, and that drives the interaction. It's not the only reason you interact with people and it doesn't, you know, determine everything, but it's different. Talking to somebody to sell to them is different than like us talking today to just.
Well, it's much more different for them. Because when I speak to people, I feel like I'm a sales consultant. I'm not thinking I've got to close this deal. I hope, but I'm not worried about it if I don't. It's kind of like not caring if you get laid with a hot chick at the bar. You got to be yourself in the right mindset. It to me, talking to people in sales consulting is just like talking like you and I are right now. I don't have any expectations. I want to find out what they need. Can we help them? Is it a waste of my time? Is it a waste of their time? So, I mean, I sold some highly technical stuff and dealt with companies that would only buy from a few people. I wasn't selling insurance or cars or stuff like that. I mean, I couldn't do that. So, you know, I studied a lot. I studied many courses in sales and studied personalities and learned to identify personality types, body language, and moderate pitch and tonality depending on who I'm speaking with, which is something really hard to do in my personal life, but it's easy to do professionally. And so I enjoyed it. But, you know, after 20 years of people just not trusting you because you're a salesperson,
sure.
it's kind of about as fun as being a dentist, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm, like I said, I'm burnt out on it. I'm just like, you know, I could do it again for the right company, but you know, I always did better when I was spending most of my time talking to design engineers, thermal engineers, mechanical engineers, because I have an engineering background and we talk about engineering stuff. And I wasn't going, ooh, you know, this semiconductor's got sparkles on it. You know,
I mean, you need
to buy this, you know. And so, but, you know, whenever I tell anyone, especially women, I'm in sales, they go, cringe a little.
Well, it's the same thing. Like nobody, I'm lucky because nobody knows what rhetoric is. So when they hear me say I'm a rhetorician, like they're like, what the hell is that? And then I'm like, well, it's persuasion. You know, I've got a PhD in persuasion. And then they start to get nervous. They're like, are you going to manipulate me? I said, did I say I'm going to manipulate you? Did I say PhD in manipulation? I said persuasion. And again, this is one of the reasons why I distinguish very clearly about, I teach ethical persuasion, because you can be incredibly effective with ethical persuasion, which is what you're talking about, that you're there to give them the information they need to make a good decision about whether to buy this thing or not.
And right. That's ethical.
Giving out information so they can make a good decision is an ethical type of communication, even though it's persuasive, you know?
Sure. Sure. You know? Yeah. I mean, I mean, everything you said, but I mean, I just got to a Zen state in my career that it was no longer cared about the commission. I didn't want anyone to be angry with me post sale.
Right. That's a law.
Anyone have buyer's remorse and
that's
go
bad persuasion, right? Like if you ruin the relationship, if they're not happy with what happened, then you were a bad persuader.
Right. Right. Well, I guess you could say that. I guess I'm taking the word persuasion as more in line with or parallel to manipulation. But definitely a persuasive salesperson. Yes. People seem to like me. So tell me more. I'm so curious. You've got a PhD in rhetoric. Tell me about your certificates. Do you have some plaques on the wall? Have you framed some things? What do you mean when you say you have a PhD in rhetoric?
Are you questioning what rhetoric is? Like what that actual academic program?
No, I'm questioning your credentials. Which major university did you achieve a PhD in rhetoric from?
Well, rhetoric, my friend, is one of the oldest academic areas there is. Like the Greeks taught rhetoric as part of their trivium. The three base things that you took were rhetoric, grammar, and logic. And you had to pass those before you could go into the higher order education. And so rhetoric's been around for a long time. It got submerged into marketing and advertising and, you know, political science and things like that. But rhetoric has a huge tradition in academics. University of Texas at Austin is easily top 10, maybe top 5 in rhetoric programs.
Really?
Yeah.
So I could enroll and take a class at University of Texas in rhetoric.
Absolutely. You could take, there's probably 50 classes over there in rhetoric.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. You see how ignorant I am.
Well, everybody is. It's not one of the major things that people get taught anymore. We never get taught about persuasion. Like, you said you did a bunch of courses and did some self-teaching and things like that to increase your sales effectiveness. That's rhetoric. It's just very focused on a very particular type of persuasion, which is in business.
You're absolutely right.
So, you know, people take political science, like even lawyers don't get trained in rhetoric, which makes no sense because they're arguing things for a living. And rhetoric is sort of the 2,500 year history of like all the great techniques that have been developed and then abstracted out so you can learn that stuff. But yes, my degrees, I went to University of Texas for my master's degree. And then I went to University of South Florida for my PhD. And my PhD actually has Jeb Bush signed on it because he was the governor back then.
How much do you love that?
Yeah, it's pretty funny to have... Jeb Bush decided I was academically qualified.
So, what types of jobs does someone get with a PhD in rhetoric? Do you teach yourself today? I mean, I know you teach in a roundabout way, but do you teach formal classes?
I was a professor for almost 20 years, so rhetoric professors teach communication courses. It's within general communication studies departments. Rhetoric is taught. Rhetoric is typically more about public communication. It's a study of effective public communication. So it comes from the history of speeches, like studying how people speak in public. And now it's everything. It's TV, it's film, it's anything that's a public message rhetoricians will study.
You know, I had no idea this about you, and it's amazing that you just don't show your cards, I guess. You're a pretty good poker player. Known you for years, but I had no idea you were a professor for 20 years. No idea.
Yeah, it was a thing. I did that for a long time. I was always running both careers. I was doing stand-up. I started as a professor after I got my master's degree when I was 24 at the University of Louisville, started teaching, and I started doing stand-up at the same time. So I ran both careers concurrently. But rhetoric, you know, is this sort of really interesting trove of techniques and strategies and theories that nobody ever accesses. So,
I had a formal training for public speaking that a big software company paid for. And I've given technical conferences to groups as large as like 120 people. And then, you know, for a while, I was doing 20 to 30 people a week every couple days. And just basically, a lot of it is crowd control, you know, same things they teach you in stand-up, like how do you handle a heckler? Involve them. Get them into the program. Ask them a direct question. Shut them down, you know? And so that's a lot of the stuff you're talking about, I believe.
Yeah, and there's, you know, human beings have to influence each other, and we have to do public communication. So we learn it. We just do it through informal systems versus like formal traditions and rhetoric. So you learn pieces of it instead of kind of the whole thing. Marketing pulls out some of it and sales training pulls out some of it, but not the whole thing. That's why, you know, I taught, like I said, rhetoric courses and speech writing and speech analysis and TV writing and all these things for years. And I got tired of the university. Like, the university is not the right environment for me. Like, it's a tough job. And then the last few years, I've wanted to go back and rescue that stuff and turn it into courses to teach to, you know, actual human beings instead of 18-year-olds.
Oh, okay. So, okay. I was going to ask you, tell me why it's a tough job. I didn't know if it was the politics of the university and your colleagues or was it because of you dealing with 18-year-olds?
It's all of it. It's really four jobs. Like, there's the teaching, which I loved. I love dealing with information, doing public performance. So that was great. But then it's grading, and grading is horrific. Like, it's the worst.
It's worse. Terrible. It's just reading. It's a task you don't want to do.
Well, it's reading their stuff, and that's horrible because, you know, they're learning kinda.
Yeah.
So like, you're up here and you study this stuff all the time, and then you're reading it down here and you're like, oh my God, you're killing me.
Yeah.
And then they get very litigious and very upset about their grades because it ties into their lives. And that's not fair to them.
It affects their lives.
So you become in conflict with your students. That's right. That's ridiculous.
Yes. There were a couple occasions I went to my English teacher and protested my grade.
Yeah. Keep going.
Well, I mean, I guess I intimidated them because I got a better grade when I left. I started with a C- and left with a B+. So, I mean, maybe because I was bigger than him or I was direct and forceful. Who knows?
You know the reason? You want to know the professor reason?
Get the student out of my way so I can go on with my life?
Yep, it's easier. It's easier just to give them the grade. Like, why deal with this?
Yeah, well, I guess the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right?
Yeah, or the squeaky wheel gets replaced. That's my favorite version of that.
Gets replaced? He's talking about firing people that complain all the time.
Well, you know, you said this early in this conversation, you know, like wanting a business guy to get into politics and sort of run the society from a governmental perspective. The problem is, like, a lot of the business concepts don't really apply in societies very well. Like, you can't fire people from the society. Right? It's like a family. You don't get to fire people from your family. They don't just disappear and go get another job or another family. There's some business principles that work very well within the idea of government, I think, and some that don't work very well at all. Like,
are you saying firing your staff members because they're not performing up to your expectations is something you shouldn't do?
No, I think you always have to have that option, but firing them because, you know, you have a whim and they're not loyal enough to you is not particularly a good strategy. It's nice to have that power if you want kind of emperor power, but, you know, that you're fired thing that Trump was allowed to do for 10 years on TV or whatever didn't translate that well to politics, it seemed like.
No, he He did expect a lot, and he had good people around him that he let go or fired and ran off. You know, and Attorney General Barr is one of them who's, you know, basically didn't like him and didn't want to deal with him and hated it. But he took the job because he wanted the job and he thought he could do it fairly. So, you know, I respect him for that. I respect the ones that stood up to him. You know, I
mean, how do you think you would have done with Trump? If you were working with Trump, how do you think you would have done?
When I was in project management, my boss told me you should apply. They had an open audition casting call in Austin. He said, you should go do that. You're a project manager. In every job, they have a project manager. And I said, that dude would fire me in the first week. There's no way I'm going through this bullshit. You see these people crying and all this stuff. And he'd sit across the table and go, you're fired. You know, I'd probably leap across the table and punch him one just for the effect, you know. And I think he had one of his sons on the show, too. I don't know if it was Eric or Trump Jr. or whatever. And I mean, remember that at the show was horrible, but I mean, you know, the jobs they gave them were pretty difficult to do. They were all sales and marketing jobs. They really didn't have anything to do with project management. They said someone's a project manager, someone's the leader. They should have just said, you know, you're the marketing manager. It really didn't make much sense to me. I thought the show was horrific. I did watch it out of curiosity, but there's no way I want to be on that. No.
So you couldn't have worked with Trump, but you would vote for him.
I didn't vote for him.
But would you vote for him? You seem to be like you don't seem anti-Trump.
I things I point out is what I point out in all my political posts when they get political is hypocrisy. All right. I mean, the liberal media is owned by the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I'm going to pull you back to that in a minute. We don't have to do it right now. Okay. But that, again, you know, choosing your terms and defining them and then a claim. And is it true?
Sure.
Like liberal media is a crazy term that everybody has somehow adopted. And I'm like, okay, so go back, keep going.
Yeah, well, I mean, so yeah, I think you threw me off my mark there with that. You know, I mean, like, Obama, I just saw.
I said you're
Obama.
Not anti-Trump, and you were starting to talk about that.
Yeah. I think he had a lot of flaws. I'm glad it wasn't Hillary. I think he did a lot of good things to reposition the United States' strength as far as trade relations. He wasn't afraid to go meet with Russia. He wasn't afraid to go meet with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. You know, he had balls. And, you know, everybody thought he's going to start a war. He's going to go there and start a war. Well, you know, he goes and meets with the little short guy from Korea, and then they stop doing missile testing. Okay. I mean, you know, the guy's a negotiator. You know, he comes off real brash on TV, but they say when he's in a meeting, he's actually, you know, pretty nice guy and pretty decent. You don't see that, though. Okay. So, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, HLN, CNN, you know, you got Google, you got Twitter. They're all saying he's a horrible person. And Obama says, if you watch Fox, you are living on another planet. Okay. So, you know, I've got a theory. You know, there's this old saying that if you're young and you're not a Democrat, you have no heart. And if you're old and you're a Democrat, you have no brain. Right. I think liberals make decisions from a place of feeling, from emotion. I think conservatives make decisions based on facts. I'll go a little step further. Just my general observation. I believe there's a larger preponderance of conservatives have bachelor of science degrees. And there's also inversely a larger preponderance of liberals who have a bachelor of arts degrees. If more people studied math and science, I wouldn't have to listen to so many stupid man-made climate change conversations. You know, that's how I feel about it. I hate explaining stuff to my friends all the time.
Okay. Yeah. All that wonderful. I love it. I think all that is a very, you know, common way of understanding like the difference between conservatives and, you know, liberals. I think those are very, you stated them very well. My term I'm going to come back and pull out on you is facts. Okay. So Bachelor of Science, and I know tons of engineers. I started out as an engineer and I've worked in technical fields a lot doing marketing and things like that. And I know what the engineering mind is like. It really likes to hold on, you know, before it makes a judgment, before it goes with, you know, the dominant way of looking at things or public opinion or the heart or anything else. It wants information.
Right.
You know, and I think that's, I think that's a really, you know, viable way of looking at the world is let's look at facts before we make our decisions. So the question is, can you get to facts from sort of media, no matter what the media is, so that you can enact that policy? And I hear a lot of conservatives will say things like you've pulled out, you know, different facts along the way about like what you just did about Obama versus, you know, Hillary versus this, and you'll hit me with a fact, or like climate science. And you clearly have some derision towards man-made climate science, right? At least that's what you communicated to me. So, you know, I'm like, okay, well, you got to give me like real facts. Like, do you study climate science? If you're going to use that system on me, because I would love to know what the actual answers are.
Okay. All right. Well, the standing number from scientists since 1990 is that 90% of greenhouse gases are contributed by naturally happening volcanic activity. That would mean 10% is man-made. Okay. So to think that, oh, we only have 12 years left to live on this earth, I think we're fleas on a dog's ass. I think the world's going to survive without us. Could we do better? Yes. Shutting down the Keystone Pipeline. Well, isn't that kind of just cutting off your nose to spite your face? I mean, now we're going to transport oil through tanker trucks on the highway or trains, and both those burn fossil fuels to transport. The pipeline did not burn fossil fuels to transport it. So it seems like both parties always have their three things. And on the Democratic Party, it's climate change is a big scare. It's get people scared. It's a great motivator in rhetoric to believe that we need to do something fast or we're all going to die. And so, you know, but canceling that project and putting 16,000 people out of work halfway through the project, is that really helping the Green Party in any way?
Okay, so let me slow you a little bit. So we're trying to do facts right now because we're trying to do science-based decisions, right? You just talked about it, like doing fear rhetoric and pushing people to positions through fear. Nobody really likes that idea. That's an unethical persuasion technique. You know, and you hear a lot of people call that out. So let's not use fear to do our politics and let's use facts to do our politics. So what I'm asking, like you, like, yes, I think everybody would love to do science-based politics. So climate change, you know, you pulled out this 90% versus 10%. That's a very distinct set of numbers, and engineers love numbers, right? That's how they make their decisions. Well, where did that come from? What does that actually mean? Like, do you study climate science?
Where did where did I get it? It's been a reported number by scientists. Like I said, the first time I heard it was 1990.
Yeah.
So I've been hearing that same number.
But I have all that stuff in my head too. Like that it's come from somewhere and I kind of remember it and all that, but I have no idea whether it's true. And I have no idea what the source is or anything else. So that's not science. That's not fact.
Okay. So I'm gonna hit the ping pong back onto your side of the table. What percentage of global warming do you believe is man-made?
400%.
And do you have any science to back it up?
412%.
That's funny. So, I mean, do you have a real answer?
Yeah, that's my belief. Like every single molecule of climate change is man-made. That's my belief because I know nothing about it.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. So do you believe the earth is just completely stagnant and humankind is the only thing that influences climate change and waves and tidal waves and forest fires? And I mean, do you believe this all contributed by man?
Now, I'll give you the real answer. I believe it's an incredibly complex system. And I don't know anything about it. Like cow farts, right? That was a thing because cows are eating grain instead of grass and therefore more methane. And then that's, you know, methane is particularly bad for the environment. I've heard this. Is that true? Yes. I have no idea.
Is it a contributor? Yes. But the thing is, what's the percentage? You know, and AOC wants to ban, you know, the cattle industry, but she's also a vegan too. So she's got a, you know, a biased opinion.
Yeah, it's her carrots are going to kill us. I think it's the carrots.
Well, cattle are raised in a very unethical manner, and we probably should be eating less meat.
Don't be so mean to cows.
Yeah.
So my point is, and this is, you know, I think one of our issues in our politics is that we have such complicated systems. And we're thinking people, a lot of people thinking, I think you're exactly right. I think there are a lot of conservatives are more science, bachelor science people, and they're looking for, you know, better answers than sort of emotional, emotionally driven rhetoric. You know, it doesn't work on them, right? They're like, quit hitting me with your feel sorry for this or feel sorry for that. I don't care. I want to know what the actual numbers are. And I think if we could get that, we would probably be okay if we could get real information. But media doesn't give you real information.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't anywhere.
And if you Google it anywhere, you know, you'll look up five sources that tell me they'll say that Paul's absolutely wrong that volcanoes contribute 90% of greenhouse gases. And I'll look up five sources that say I'm right. And you're going to go, well, which one do we choose? And you'll fact check it, or I'll fact check it. And depending on which site you go to, you can get a different answer because Google's writing their own definitions of words now. If you Google a word, instead of your first option, it's not Merriam-Webster, right? It's not the Oxford Dictionary. It's Google's answer, and you read it and go, that doesn't look like the last definition I read in a dictionary. I've got a dictionary from 30 years ago, and I can look at that and go, well, how'd that change so much? And it seems politically manipulated.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think what we're all realizing is that we're living in a world that's very different. All of our information is incredibly squishy.
Yes. Look, I've got geologists in my family. I had to study geology as part of my work as a oil field engineer for Halliburton. I've gotten information from my brother-in-law who studies this stuff quite a bit. Now, he tells me climate change is being exaggerated because you're not measuring enough data. They're looking at 50-year snapshots and not hundreds of year snapshots.
Totally possible. Right.
So you know what? I trust someone who has a master's degree and has done it for 25 years. I don't feel like I need to go study climate change myself, right? I think I can listen to a number of sets of data and go, well, all those seem to line up, and maybe there's some truth there, right?
But that is...
Versus AOC saying, we've got 12 years or the Earth's going to be over with, and there's some girl in New Zealand crying on the video. What was her name? Poor little girl is crying.
Greta Thunberg? Was that her? Was that the Nordic woman?
Yeah, poor girl.
Yeah.
And so there you go. There's rhetoric manipulating a young mind.
Yeah,
she's going to die.
You want a good crying 12-year-old on your side. That's very effective. Much more effective than, you know, some guy sitting up there with his graphs and his numbers. So the question is, like, how do we operate in the squishy times? Like, you're a smart person. You're like, okay, I know this guy and I've kind of listened to him and it makes sense to me much more so than, you know, a politician from Brooklyn sitting here and, you know, being very upset about things and doing hyperbole. And so you make a decision based on it, but it's still a bad decision. It's a bad decision system because it's squishy information. And like, no engineer is going to say, you know, I'm going to build this bridge and I'm going to kind of trust this guy who, you know, sort of builds bridges. And then my family's going to drive over that bridge day one.
I think that's reaching
engineers.
I don't think engineers act that way, and they wouldn't ruin their fucking career, obviously. But But again, you know, while we're talking about it, you know, the new Green Deal, yeah, renewable energy, yes. I mean, every time I drive to New Mexico to see my sister, windmill farms in San Angelo and up through Lubbock and the Panhandle, love them, right? The fact is they take 3.5 years to make pay themselves off and make it profitable. The fact is they snow froze them up and they contributed nothing during this Texas freeze, right?
I don't know, now, man. You're hitting me with, you know, claims and facts that I can't know whether these are true or not.
They contribute a small amount to the grid so far. Now, water energy, wave generation, that's a new thing. Why do we not have more hydroelectric dams? We used to have more. Why are we cutting down on those? I think anything renewable is great, but turning off a pipeline right now is not a good idea because gas prices are just going
to
go up.
Now you're dragging me over to pipelines. I don't know shit about pipelines either. You know, you had me up in the atmosphere.
Yeah, okay.
The entire history of the planet.
So I'm saying until we have sustainable energy that works and can supply the entire grid, you don't cut off a major artery that's going to put everybody in a lurch.
So my point...
That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I agree. Like, who would say... What rational person would say, yeah, get rid of all our energy and just rely on this, you know, sketchy, you know, windmill? Nobody's going to want that. You know, that's a bad idea. And so the question again, like for me as a rhetorician, is to go back to the big picture of how do people make political decisions in an age of squishy information? It's really challenging, you know?
I think, they've done a very good job of the two-party system, and that's why I vote independent and boycott. Texas is going to turn blue. We're going to get enough immigrants into Texas, and it's going to turn blue. They say, and, you know, you don't know who they are, and so this isn't the
legal Californians. Legal, we got to make it illegal to move here from California, and then they have to sneak in.
They didn't do much for the housing market in Austin, that's for sure.
I moved here right at the beginning of that boom. I bought a house that got, you know, swept away in a divorce. But I watch, you know, I look what I paid for it and what it is now. And I'm like, oh, that hurts. That hurts.
Was that the house I moved you into up above 183?
No, that was a different then. I used to have a house in Crestview right down by 2222 across from McCallum.
Yeah, that must hurt.
Yeah, that's like $200,000-$300,000 more in that house right now than, you know, so. Oh, well, yeah. What can you do? Well, hey, man, I'm going to cut us off because we're well over an hour, and I really appreciate your time. You know, it's always super fun to kind of talk to you about things in general, but, you know, jump in and talk politics, and I like it.
Well, I hope you did learn something.
I did. I've changed my mind about many things based on your perspectives.
Okay. Well, listen, cut this off and I got a few comments for you afterwards.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that. So let me close up here. Hey, once again, everybody, thanks. Anything you need to promote or anybody want to give you a job in Colorado? You want to give Paul a job in Colorado, anybody?
Anybody in project management, like somebody wants to work in the field, has technical aptitude and will argue with you about anything.
There you go. That's on his business card. I will argue with you about anything, but I have technical aptitude. That's Paul Sontag, everybody. Hey, come back and see us again on Rhetoric Warriors. Pop over and take a course. I'm just about to release a new course in the top 21 things you have to know to persuade anybody about anything. And learn some stuff about rhetoric. It's going to help you in life. It's going to make us a better country, and you'll even sell more stuff. There's the pitch. I'll see you again next time.